Isn't it funny how the best chats are often had in the car on a long drive? Yeah, you're swapping stories, you're having a laugh, and you're solving the world's biggest problems. So welcome to Car Chats, where we put you in the back seat and get the backstory of some of our favorite humans and hopefully learn something along the way. In this episode of Car Chats, we were lucky enough to go for a drive with the godmother of compassion, the incredible Lael Stone. I often tell people there's no such thing as human being school, where you can learn to be a human being first and a human doing second. But I can't actually say that anymore because Lael actually created one. In my opinion, the world's first human being school, where intrinsic motivations are more important than extrinsic results. The amazing Woodlawn Primary School in Ceres, Victoria. An incredible achievement. Okay, in this episode, we discuss what compassion means and how we can cultivate more of it in our lives. Yeah, we chat about how anger is healthy, but transferring it onto others is unhealthy. And as a consequence, anger needs its own marketing campaign. We also talk about how EQ might just be more important than IQ for dealing with ambiguity raising kids in the world right now. I hope you enjoyed the chat as much as I enjoyed taking you for a ride.
Now, Lael, many people have suggested you and I have to do a podcast together
yes,
one day.
So, yes.
Are we going to call it Stone the Crows?
Oh, my God. I love that. I never thought about that. That's brilliant. That's good.
I have a serious bone to pick with you.
Yes.
Because, like you, give a lot of talks around the world. And I tell the story of this celebrity who once said there's no such thing as fame school where you can learn to be famous. And I thought, that's true. But there's also no such thing as human being school where you can learn to be a human being first and an athlete second. Until you actually did it, right, with Woodlawn Primary. So what was the inspiration behind literally setting up a school around, in my opinion, the most important work on the planet today is the work that you're doing?
Well, it's funny. I often love to, when I share this story, to say I never had an intention to set up a school. Like, I was not sitting there thinking this would be a good thing to do because, I mean, I have my own hang-ups with education. I didn't even like education, right? So I was
in touch with that emotion.
Never something that I was going to do. It came about because one of my clients, who I've been working with for a few years, so she had six kids, so there was a lot of stuff to work through. So in that kind of therapeutic level, we'd come and work through her kids and their stories and where she was at as a parent. And one of her children was starting primary school. And she's from America, and so he was starting prep. And she was like, oh, he hates it. You know, he has to, he's being told what to do all the time, and he can't move his body when he wants to, and he has to ask over the toilet. He's not allowed to eat when he needs to eat, and his name keeps being put up on the board because he's talking. And she's saying to me, is this what school is here in Australia? And I'm like, yep, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then she just said to me, well, what if we built a school based on all the things that you've taught me? And so, of course, I laughed because that's what you do when someone says that. And she said, no, I'm really serious. She said, look, I'll fund it and I'll kind of set up the infrastructure, but you build the school that you think should exist for children. And so,
what a brief.
Well, it was so overwhelming. Like, I just kind of went, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then I just went, no. And I reckon I froze on it for a few months because I was like, I can't do that. I have no idea what to do. I'm not a teacher. I actually just went, no, that feels too big. And so I just was like, yeah, that's a great idea. And you know, the reality actually is that when someone offers you a whole lot of money to do something and says, go build something that you think should exist. I mean, I think for many people, like, oh, that would be my dream, but it's actually quite scary.
Nah, totally,
because you're just like, oh, I could mess this up and I don't even know if I know what I'm doing.
Imposter syndrome kicks in.
All of the things. So, I mean, Mel was amazing because she was very persistent. She's like, come on, Lael, come on, let's do it. And I don't really remember where it was, but at one point, at some point, I remember just having this moment, you know, when you get those flashes where you just think, well, who am I not to do this? It just takes one person to be courageous enough to do something new. And why not me? Like, why not me? Yes, I don't know what I'm doing. Yes, I feel very out of my depth. Yes, I'm going to need a lot of help and support. But what I did know, and I think this is what drove me, is that I had worked with families for a really long time. I I knew about trauma. I knew from listening to so many adult stories about the pain and the experiences they've had at school of being shamed or bullied or not being seen or the pressure to do something right because that's what their parents thought. And I was like, there has to be a different way to do education. And even personally for me, I'd watched my three kids struggle in the education system. Mm. So I think I did understand the child and I understood what it was that helps people thrive. And then when Mel said, let's do this, I was like, okay, let's do it. And I kind of put it out there to the world to be like, all right, if I'm going to do this, I need the right people to show me, because I'm a big fan in learning from others and, yeah. and doing the apprenticeship. And so we met some amazing consultants who guided us and helped kind of form and build what we were doing. And it took 3 years of my life to bring it to fruition. And then wow. we opened. And the day we opened, I just cried the whole day because I could not believe we'd done it. And I was also probably a little bit sitting there thinking, God, I hope this works. I've just asked people to sign up for this thing and what if it doesn't work? But I always knew it was going to work. But I think it's with anything when you take a risk, right? I just want to make sure that this is going to be something that is going to serve children. And one of the best parts of this story, I think, is that we've been open for 3 years now and the school is way better than I ever dreamed it could be. And that to me is one of the most beautiful parts of it. It's like a beautiful vision and a dream, and it's even better than what you think.
Totally, totally. When you say you hope that it works, what is success?
Well, for me, I think what I kept seeing success is I want children to leave our school knowing that by the time they finish, they are deeply connected to themselves. They know how they learn best. They are able to express their feelings in healthy ways. They are able to ask for support. And they're deeply in tune and connected to their spirit. Yeah. For me, that was the goal and the success of the school, right? And it's not about grades and it's not about being the smartest, but it's about having deep connection to who we are as humans. Because I find, and you would say the same thing, that is a lot of the work that we end up doing as adults, is trying to figure out where that connection and that spirit is.
Yeah.
And if we can foster that in children right from the beginning, then imagine who they're going to be as adults.
Yeah, yeah. I find that so fascinating because people ask me about what is success, and there's the extrinsic external success, you know, making money, winning titles and so forth. But the bigger KPI for me is how people turn out in 30, 40 years, what kind of parent, what kind of friend, what kind of son, what kind of daughter you are and so forth. But I feel like you're coming at it from the most important age bracket, right? Right from the get-go.
Yeah.
Has it always been that way, and is it just more pronounced now, the need for more emotionally intelligent? I feel like it's always been there.
Yeah.
But maybe life was simpler or more autocratic and...
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, when we look at something like education, our education system was set up for the industrial age. So it was actually set up to create workers, which isn't about being free thinking and about being creative and all that kind of stuff. It was about, we just want you to do a job and get on with it. And to some degree, that's a little bit about what our education system's still about, is we all want you to conform and do the same thing.
Mm.
Whereas actually that's not what the world needs. You know, the world needs creatives and free thinkers and all those kind of things. So I think our system needs a big overhaul because it doesn't serve the times we're living in now. But I think from an emotional awareness point of view, I think we're living in a completely different time. You know, many, many years ago, we were all about living in the village and many people raised the children and we shared and pooled resources. And, you know, we lived kind of in that beautiful village mentality where life was simpler. Whereas now we're living on our own in these little apartments and expected to raise kids by ourselves and then get it all right and tick all the boxes. And it's highly, highly stressful. And so because our children are being born into these quite stressful environments, I think that's why we need to have EQ as kind of the top of the pecking order at the moment to help us understand who we are as humans, because we're actually being born into really stressful times.
Yeah, but it feels like the education system just can't get its either head around that or can change structurally or attitudinally, right? Because even the workforce, being a owner of a company, you're looking for people who can deal with ambiguity and have empathy and are more emotionally intelligent.
Yeah.
So it's almost more luck than design when you get that from the education system.
Yeah, and I think, look, I always, when I talk about education, I have so much compassion for teachers because I think they are doing an incredibly difficult job in a really difficult system. And our system at the moment is still driven by data and by grades and marks and that what we deem as success, right? Which is that whole, you get good grades, go to university, get a degree, you know, you get a great job, drive a great car, make a lot of money. Like, I think we're still thinking that that is successful.
Yeah.
I mean, I joke that these days, I think what success is a calm nervous system. I'm like, that's my goal.
Totally.
These days. I'm like, do I wake up and feel calm in my body? I'm like, yes, we're winning, right?
That's ultimately the definition of mindfulness. Yeah, to be calm and present.
Yeah, like, totally.
Imagine if you could do that. You and I had a coffee over the summer, and I think you asked me what I think is going on in the world, and I said, the world is completely distracted. And I asked you the same question. I think you said the world's asleep. Can you unpack that for me? It's a big ass question, right? Like, what's going on in the world right now?
Yeah.
What's your take on it? We'll get more granular, but I'm really curious. Like, what the is going on in the world right now?
Well, I think that we have been living in a time where we've been really taught to be disconnected from ourselves, from our bodies and from our souls and from our hearts. And if we go back further, right, and again, I always come from a place of deep compassion and understanding. I have a fundamental belief that we are all doing the best job we know how. I absolutely 100% believe that. Our parents were, our grandparents were, we're all doing the best that we can with what we have.
Whatever skills, whatever lessons.
Totally.
Whatever,
so there's no blame or no judgment. But I think when I kind of break it down, I break it down to this. Most of us, or our generation, or our parents' generation, were raised in a time where we weren't taught to be connected to our feelings and our center. So, and this comes back to the kind of whole behaviorism paradigm, right? So that when we were upset as kids, we were told, don't be silly, or you're too much, or, you know, think positive, or, you know, go to your room and come out when you're happy. Most of us were raised in a way where we learned right from the beginning, it's not okay to feel these big feelings and emotions I've got sitting here. And because our drive is for connection and attachment, we learn pretty quickly to repress those feelings or to shut them off in order to just survive. Like, a lot of times for people, it's not safe for them to be angry or upset, right? They've got to lock that down just to be okay in that family of origin where they're at. And I think because we are taught from a young age to repress those feelings, well, then we have to repress that true essence within ourselves and that point of connection. So we learn to betray ourselves a lot, and we learn to disassociate a lot. And so when we're talking about being asleep, I think most of us were brought up in environments where we weren't taught healthy emotional literacy. We weren't taught that our feelings are okay. We weren't taught healthy ways of how to express those feelings.
Yeah.
And so therefore, a lot of it just stays locked within us, and we work hard to keep repressing it or numbing it. And that's what I mean when I say I think half the world is asleep. Well, actually not half, most of the world is asleep, because we're so disconnected from what we actually feel. And then what we do is we walk through the world being reactive when someone doesn't do something that we want them to do, or they say something and we get offended by it, or, you know, we are basically operating from the defensive part of us that's kind of full of feelings and emotions, instead of being able to be from a place where we can be curious and we can be compassionate and we can sit there and go, hey, what am I feeling in this moment? That's for me to own, and I need to work through it. You know, a lot of people actually just come in really hot and reactive to whatever's going on. And that's why, you know, we have similar questions we ask. I always ask people I work with is, what are you making this mean? You know, when you're having a reaction to someone, what are you making this mean? What is this
as
about?
In what story are you telling yourself in that moment about that situation?
And a lot of the times it's connected to those deeper, younger parts of us that didn't get their needs met.
Yeah. And then bringing that back, then the work need to be done is giving people the skills to make sense of, I think you call them imprints, in terms of the stories that we tell ourselves and where they came from, so that you can apply compassion and empathy to yourself first and foremost, getting back to we're all doing the best job that we can.
Yeah. Well, I really fundamentally believe we have to understand our stories first to understand ourselves. So, yeah. You know, when we look at simple things like, well, why do I get really frustrated when my partner packs the dishwasher the wrong way, right? Or why do I lose it when my kids won't do what I want them to do? And look, sometimes we've got basic stress needs and that's how we respond and react, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of the time, our reactions and responses are these kind of conditioned imprints that we often receive as children. And so, for an example, like, you know, if you grew up in a family where the message you got was nobody cries, like, don't be upset. You know, you're weak if you cry, don't be vulnerable. You learn pretty quickly on that it's not okay to be vulnerable. So in order to survive, you learn ways to shut those feelings down.
Yeah.
And then you grow into adolescence or into early adulthood, and when anything feels emotional, your imprint or your reaction is going to be don't feel it, like, lock it in, you know, shut it down.
Yeah.
And then we move into relationships, and then you have a partner who's like, why won't you feel anything? And why don't you tell me how you feel? And you're kind of stuck because you're like, I can't, or it's not safe.
You've been taught to repress.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so we have to go back to firstly understanding the story, which is, well, you know, that's what was modeled to me in my family of origin, and everybody was doing the best they can, but I understand why I am the way I am. And then we have to start looking at, well, how do I want to be? What do I want this imprint to be? Because the thing with imprints is we can actually change them. They're just stories and belief systems that we believe to be true, and then we keep looking for evidence that they're true.
Yeah.
So you actually can change it. And the way we change something like that is, all right, well, I need to create enough safety in my life or find places and examples of where it is okay to feel and that it is safe for me to cry. And maybe you start by watching, you know, those beautiful videos on YouTube where dogs are, you know, reunited with their owners, or like, you know, people come back from war, or just something, you know, something that makes you cry and you go, hey, I can have some tears and it's okay.
Yeah.
And everyone's still all right. And then it might be finding enough space of trust with someone, you know, that they listen compassionately to you, and then you have a cry and that feels safe. And then we get more evidence and we start to build the evidence toolkit that it's okay for me to actually feel like this.
Yeah.
And it's not just feelings and emotions, it's everything. Like, we have imprints around everything, from our relationship to money, to doing jobs we love, to trust, to what healthy relationships look like, to our bodies, to everything. We're imprinted with everything. And some of those imprints are brilliant and wonderful and service, and then some actually don't. And I think we often have to keep asking the questions, you know, what's here and what do I make this mean, and what is this about for me?
Yeah. Isn't it funny, getting back to, where do you go to learn this? Getting back to Woodline Primary and the school you've created, is part of that to teach the kids about their imprints and how to kind of own their story and make sense of their story?
Yeah, so in really, I guess what we're doing there is, one of the things that we do is that we are very welcoming of all feelings. So we are a non-punitive discipline school, which means we don't kids' names on the board if they do something wrong. We don't ever shame children. We don't use rewards. We are always looking behind the behavior. So what we know is that when a child is out of balance, right, when they're having a hard time in the classroom or they can't learn, it's the adult's job to be like, oh, I wonder what's going on here. Instead of kind of defaulting to, oh, they're difficult, or why won't they just do what they're told, we're always curious as to, there's got to be something happening here.
Yeah.
So let's dig a bit deeper.
Yeah.
Now then, when we lean into that and perhaps we see that this child just needs to move their body, so we go jump on the trampoline, or we go for a run, or we go visit the animals, or we have a chat about what's sitting underneath. Because when we meet that usually that need for whatever's happening with those feelings, and it's able to be expressed, and they come back into balance and they're ready to learn, right?
That's what you mean by in balance and out of balance.
Yeah. So we
is that a question, by the way, that we should be asking ourselves, like, constantly, am I in balance or out of balance?
Totally.
Because that's something I feel like you could teach someone pretty young. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, and here's the thing, you know, and I say to parents often, you know, when your kids are in balance, you know, because you can hear them singing in their bedroom, and they come out and they're all cute to the dog, and they go up to their siblings and they're like, hey, do you want to hang out together? And you ask them to do something and they usually happily will do it. You know, it's those moments where you feel like you're winning as parents. Because you think, look at my kid.
Yep, and when your it's
kids,
all me.
Yeah, when your kids are out of balance, it's, you know, when they walk into the room and, like, elbow their sister in the head, or, you know, grumble that I have to do everything in this family, or whatever it is, and you can see that there's tension. You see that they're out of balance. And our job as a parent is to be really curious, to go, all right, I wonder what's making them out of balance. There's something that's there. There's sometimes there's a need that needs to be met. Sometimes there's information information they need. But a lot of the time it can be stresses or past hurts that are sitting there and then trying to find their way out. Because once we release those stresses and feelings, we come back into balance, right? And then we feel good again. It's like for adults, you know, when you've got this buildup of feelings and you have a cry or you talk to someone, you instantly feel better, right? Because you've moved whatever feelings need to be sat there.
Yep.
So when we look at Woodlawn, you know, part of, I guess, what we're teaching children is firstly that all their feelings are welcome. Now, we're also teaching them, hey, it's not okay to project your anger onto another child, right? It's not okay for you to pick up a chair and throw it at someone. Mm. But if you are angry, we're here to help you with that anger. Let's move it in a way that's healthy.
Yeah.
Or when somebody else is upset, can we be empathetic to them and be compassionate to their feelings, not judge them? So it's not so much about these lessons that we're teaching children, it's really about how the adults are responding to the children, because that's what becomes the imprint.
Totally.
The imprint is, it is safe for me to be all of me.
Yeah.
And I think when I strip that back to a lot of the adults I've worked with over the years, the message most of us get is, I love you when you're good.
Yeah.
Right?
Conditional.
Totally. Yeah. And our deep need as humans is to know that we are lovable, all parts of us. That you are enough just the way you are. And I find that what children are deeply searching for, like the inner child within us and children, what they're deeply looking for is, do you love and accept all parts of me? The messy parts, the funny parts, the clever parts, the creative parts, but do you deeply accept and love all part of me? Because that's actually what we're all deeply longing for as humans, is
to
be seen.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned anger before. Mm-hmm. I always thought that anger was a bad thing, and it's not good to be angry. And I've heard you talk about regression and
repression.
I've heard you talk about repression, expression, and aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the whole goal eventually to help people be able to express themselves.
Yeah,
and anger's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing, and I think. Well, I mean, bringing it back to those three things, right? We learn as humans to do kind of three things with feelings. So we either learn if it's not safe to feel, we have to shut them down. And so we're all pretty awesome at repressing stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, repression can look like just scrolling on Instagram for 2 hours. It can be eating all the ice cream or drinking all the wine.
It's kind of numbing behaviors. Yeah.
And we all learn to do it. And they're really... And repression is not necessarily something that's bad, right? There's times in our lives where we're all like, you know what, I've got to check out for a bit.
Yeah.
The issue with repression is if we do it all the time. And also the issue with repression is if we do it and we actually are not feeling, right? That's when it becomes...
So it gets back to intention.
Yeah.
Because you can also talk about acceptance.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes accepting things and letting it go is a good thing if the intentions are right.
Yeah.
Just like... repression can be a good thing.
Yeah, like you could be like, I've had a super stressful day, so much is going on. You know what? I'm going to sit here and watch Netflix for an hour. I'm consciously doing it because things feel big, and I'm going to be really compassionate to myself because that's what I need to do right now.
Yep.
That's not bad. Like, you know, you can see that as just taking care of your needs. But if we're doing it all the time, and often we're doing it unconsciously, then that's when it can become an issue.
Yep.
And again, I always come back to, and if we're not doing the feeling piece with it, then that's where it turns up in the body in different ways. So we either repress our feelings or we move into expression, which is things like crying and raging and laughing and talking and moving your body, like moving the feelings through you. Or the other one you mentioned is it can turn into aggression. So this is something that I see a lot of, and that is, you know, if we learn as children that it wasn't okay to feel, then those feelings that are sitting there within us, they're often going to stay stuck within. And then what can happen is whenever we feel really powerless, whenever we feel like someone's making fun of us, whenever we feel out of control, then that anger and aggression comes pouring out.
Yeah.
And usually onto the people that we love the most, right? So I think we have to come back to understanding that anger is not a bad thing. You know, anger is usually just a bit of a signpost that say, hey, either my boundaries have been crossed and that's not cool, or I'm feeling really powerless around a situation or something, or there's some other big feelings that are sitting underneath here and I don't want to feel them, so I'm going to mask them, and it comes out as anger and projecting onto everyone else. Because, I mean, you know, we all, as much as we don't like being angry, there's a justification that comes when we feel angry because someone's not doing what we want.
Totally.
And we can just sit in that anger and just be like, they're this and they're that. And as long as we're sitting in that, it means we don't actually have to feel often the hurt or the upset that's there.
Yeah.
So people use anger as a mask a lot, right? So here's the thing that I often talk about with anger is that anger is not a bad thing. Projecting your anger onto other people is not okay. So we want to teach children.
Gotcha. So, yeah, okay. That's a really important distinction.
Yeah. So you can be angry, right? But anger, healthy anger looks like this. I am angry, right? And that's mine. And I've got to move this anger. So yeah. I'm going to go outside and yell at the trees. Or
yeah.
I'm going to put on some music and do some angry dancing. I'm going to go for a run. I'm going to pick up socks and throw them at the wall. I'm going to...
Because anger could just be a strong no.
Yes.
I don't believe in that.
That's
I don't
it.
Agree with that.
That's
yeah.
it, yeah. yeah. And I think the thing is, one of my friends says this. She says this to her kids. I'm angry and it's nobody's fault. Right? Which is beautiful because their kids
that.
Instantly go, oh, this is not about me.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Yeah.
And as a parent, we're
and
able
the emotion's
to go,
allowed. Yeah.
I'm angry and I'm now going to model doing something to move this anger in a healthy way. Right? And so one of the things that I see a lot with a lot of the mothers that I work with is something that I call mother rage. And for me, again, this ties into our imprint a lot, that particularly as little girls in the culture we've been brought up in, we're taught from a really young age that anger's not okay. That we have to be good girls all the time. So we're allowed to cry and you can be upset, but don't be angry,
yeah.
right? And be good, like be compliant, right? So most of us grow up as good girls, wanting people's approval, doing the right thing. And then what often happens is they hit motherhood. And because motherhood is like chaos, right? And because nothing ever really goes the way that you want it to and you can't control it, then all that out of controlness kind of bubbles. And often what happens is this anger comes pouring out towards these little kiddos. And often women are really shocked. And they're like, I've been the most passive, calm person my whole life.
What's
and
happening?
Now all of a sudden I want to throw something at my kid's head. I mean, I relate. I was like that too. I was like the happiest kind of calm, no worries type person.
Yeah.
And then I became a mother and I'd never experienced rage and anger like what I felt until I began to realize that this was like a lifetime of accumulation of anger sitting in me that was now actually had a place to come out. So I think the thing is we have to redefine anger as and for a long time we've seen it as a bad feeling, a bad emotion.
Totally.
And I do not believe there's anything as a negative emotion, right? Because I think all feelings are valid, right? You know, anger is just as important as joy and sadness is just as valid as pleasure and happiness and those kind of things.
Yeah.
It's I think we've been taught for a long time that you should just be happy all the time. And that's actually not who we are as humans. You know, we are feeling beings.
Yeah.
And anger, when we're angry, it's just a signpost to say, hey, something feels out of balance for me here. You know, something, I feel like my boundaries have been crossed or there's an injustice
yeah.
and that's firing me up. So I think it's a really beautiful marker to say, hey, something needs to be given some attention here.
Totally.
And even in parenting, right, when we get angry, sometimes it's because we're not getting our needs met. Sometimes we need a break. Sometimes
yeah.
we need more sleep. Sometimes we need to eat food. Sometimes we just need some more support or we need a place to take some of those big feelings. And I mean, I'm really passionate about teaching our children healthy ways to express anger and to say anger's not bad. You don't need to just breathe your anger away. I'm like, move it through your body.
Anger needs a marketing strategy.
It does.
It needs a rebranding. But this
it's
just
so dumb.
Just the way you explained it and the way that mother says that, I'm angry and it's no one's fault.
Yeah.
It's the separation between
yeah.
it's okay to have it, it's not okay to impart it onto someone else.
That's exactly it. And it's like,
Can we do a marketing strategy for anger,
yeah.
but at the same time, compassion?
Yes.
Because I feel like,
yeah.
I'm not saying it's one or the other, but I
yeah.
feel like compassion,
yeah.
people don't understand
yeah, yeah.
what compassion means.
Totally.
And I feel like
yeah.
you're, if Brené Brown was the godmother of vulnerability, I feel like you're the godmother, fairy godmother of compassion.
That's
but I'm
so nice.
I'm actually serious here. Like
mm.
in the same way that we don't understand that anger's okay,
yeah.
we do not understand compassion.
Yeah.
Right? Why is that? There's no definition of it. We don't understand how to use it or apply it. Or yeah.
So I think the thing for me around compassion is that, again, it comes back to, and I think we build it all back to these same kind of paradigms that we've been raised in. So if we strip it back to, you know, when we were little and we were told that feelings weren't okay.
Yeah.
And particularly if we were punished, right? So if we got in trouble for making a mistake or for yelling or hitting our brother or whatever. And again, I'm not saying we don't have boundaries. Boundaries are so important.
Yeah.
But if we got punished for doing something wrong when we were kids and we maybe went into our room and we were all upset and angry because we got punished because we got told off for taking our brother's toy or something like that. And particularly if the adults yelled at us or maybe we got smacked or those kind of things, then what often happens is we take on this internal story that says, not I've done something wrong, but I am wrong. And we take on often a story that there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
Right? So there's that beautiful saying is that when we yell at a child as a parent, the child doesn't stop yelling, stop loving the parent. They actually stop loving themselves.
Yeah.
Because they begin to go, well, there's something wrong with me. So we start off with this internal talk that is often really quite harsh and punitive, right? Which sets up no compassion for, hey, I've done something wrong. Now, here's the game changer. A child can do something wrong, and as the adult, if we're aware enough and if we're calm enough, we can go, hey, I can look behind the behavior. I can see they've done something wrong. I'm going to move in with calmness. I'm going to help move whatever the feelings are that's created that situation. And then I'm going to sit in a place of compassion for my child, understanding that they are still learning and that it's probably just hurt that's fueled the behavior. So when we come in with empathy and compassion, a child then is more likely to imprint that compassion into themselves to be like, hey, I'm not wrong. You know, I just made a mistake, right? I just messed up. Now, because most of us weren't given that as children, and again, full compassion to our parents, doing the best job they know how, right? That our default is to be super critical. So when you do say something like compassion, people are like, I don't even know what that looks like. But here's the thing that I think I've learned personally from my own journey is that, you know, 15 years ago, I had really severe PTSD from an experience that was really traumatic. And I went through all those really hardcore, like anxiety and panic, and it was horrible, right? It was one of those phases of my life that you wouldn't wish upon anyone, but actually was the most powerful thing that ever happened to me. Because in the midst of all that angst and anxiety and panic, I just wanted to fix it. I wanted it to be gone. But amongst all that, what was really critical for me to understand was that I could not judge myself for how I was feeling. I kept making myself wrong for a long time for having anxiety, for having panic. And it dawned on me one day that perhaps the biggest gift of this whole experience was to actually be kind and compassionate to myself and know that how I was responding and reacting was not wrong, was just a normal response to trauma.
Yeah.
And when I got that piece, it literally changed everything in my life because...
Do you remember it was like an aha moment for you?
It was an aha moment. Yeah. I remember where it was. I remember, this is a funny story. I was at a... I was at this hippie dance class, right? It's called Five Rhythms.
Yeah.
For anyone that's into alternatives, you'll be like, oh, I know what that's like. It's like a dance class you go to for 2 hours. They turn off the lights off. Everyone dances with their eyes closed. It's great, right? It's a great way to move your body. So I'm at this dance class. I'm in the middle of all my trauma and stuff still.
Yeah.
And the facilitator of this whole dance class, she says something like this, these simple words. She's like, when you're dancing, don't abandon your body. Right? She's like, so don't abandon your hands or don't forget about them, right? Because they're all still part of you. And it was something in the way she said it that made me just go, oh, I've been abandoning myself. I've been abandoning my anxiety. I've been abandoning this panic. I've been making it wrong and it's just a part of me. Wow. And it is not wrong.
Wow.
And it was that moment that I just went, oh my God. Oh my God, I'm so sorry, Lael. I'm so sorry. I've been making you so wrong when you haven't even been doing anything wrong. You've just been trying to survive.
Yeah.
And that piece dropped in around compassion in the most powerful way. And that's actually when I started to heal. Because what I realized with that is you cannot heal unless you have compassion.
Totally.
You can't. It doesn't work. And so I had to then learn to just meet myself with compassion in every moment. And I think why I feel so passionate about compassion is because I had to do the healing for myself. And then I started looking at it through the lens of parenting with my own children. And then I started looking at it through the lens of trauma and the work I was doing. And then, you know, my school so much is based on compassion. It's what we teach all our teachers and guides and staff is, be compassionate. Look behind the behavior. You have a parent that's upset. Start with compassion. I'm really sorry to hear what's going on for you. Like, I'm here, I'm present. Because it disarms everything.
Oh my God, it's, yeah. So, simple exercises to help people practice compassion.
Yeah.
Whether you're an adult or whether you're a young kid. What are some simple things we can do to start to practice this mindset muscle that we've lost the art of?
So, I think... Well, firstly, be compassionate with your compassion. Right?
Yeah.
So don't make yourself wrong if you can't do it straight away.
Yeah.
Like, I think, I often say to people, if you can just open up like 5 or 10% of compassion for yourself, that's a start, right? So if your default is to beat yourself up because you made a mistake or you did something wrong, like, just ask yourself a question. What would compassion look like right now, right? And even if it's just the tiniest little bit of, okay, I made a mistake. Yeah, I still want to beat myself up, but I made a mistake. And so that's a starting place.
I love that. What would compassion look like right now?
Yeah, totally.
It's so simple.
It's so simple because it would be, it's literally like, well, compassion for myself right now would look like me not beating myself up about it.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll give myself a hard time for a little bit. Like, I have another great story of when I was really learning this. One time I was teaching a workshop, a class, and you know sometimes when you feel like it doesn't land, right? And
yeah. So, I've been there.
Yeah, I'm sure we all have. I got in the car and I start driving home and I'm starting to do the whole, oh, that was crap and I didn't say this bit and I don't think that's okay. And
yeah.
I was really starting to beat myself up. And then I just, as I was driving, thinking, what am I doing? Like, no, I would never allow my children to talk this way about themselves. Like, what am I doing here? And so I thought, all right, I'm going to set a boundary on this. So I said to myself, right, for the next 5 minutes, I'm allowed to talk crap about myself. And then when the timer goes off, I set a timer on my phone. That's enough. There's the boundary. So I then like set the timer and then I started to try and speak badly about myself, but it felt weird. So I kind of couldn't do it. I was like, oh, this feels weird now because I know what I'm doing. So it didn't kind of work.
Yeah.
But that was the piece where I was like, I'm going to set a boundary here because it's actually not okay to talk this way about myself. And so what would compassion look like? Well, I'll give myself a few more minutes to say all the things that I think I did wrong, and then enough, right? So we start learning to set limits internally with ourselves around how we speak to ourselves. And that actually can start to make a huge difference of leaning more towards compassion.
Yeah.
Because as you know, in so much of your beautiful work, we have 20, 30, 40, 50 years of conditioning that has spoken one way to ourselves.
Totally.
So it's not as simple as often going, right, I'm going to choose compassion now. We have to practice it. We have to practice it with others. We have to practice it with ourselves. I mean, you know, one of the other things I love, which I think is a really important thing to remember, is that a lot of people feel it's a lot easier to have compassion for others than themselves, right? So they find it hardest for themselves. But a beautiful thing when we're looking at compassion, which also ties into judgment, is that if we see a person in front of us and if we could see their life story behind them, I think that we would only have compassion for every single human on this planet, because we would see that everybody has had adversity, has had trauma, has had really hard stuff happen. And I think if we could see their story, we'd be like, oh God, they are doing an incredible job.
So true.
I remember, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, you know, those beautiful people that cross your path. I remember I was running these groups years ago and there was this guy that would come to the group and he was really challenging for everybody in the group. Like, he just spoke up a lot and, you know, his energy was tricky to be around.
Yep.
And, you know, as a facilitator, you're kind of just trying to keep everybody's needs met, and he was hard work, right? And I remember thinking, oh God, please, I hope he doesn't come to the group. And then I actually had the opportunity to do a one-on-one session with him. And then when he sat and told me his story, I was like, oh my God, he's a being who he is, considering what's happened to him. And it completely changed my lens on him, because I was like, whoa, if everybody knew his story, not that they need to, but there would not be any judgment.
Was his energy different sharing his story, that he'd been hurt?
Yeah, he was really vulnerable, and you could see that in groups it was just bravado and it was him trying to find his place.
Yeah.
But when he was when you heard his story and then I could begin to see what it was that he needed, it actually began to shift and change a bit. But I will never forget him because he was one of those really beautiful people that taught me about judgment. And he taught me about that we all have a story. And if we can learn to look through the eyes of compassion always, then we're going to come with that beautiful, compassionate heart to others. And that matters massively because when you meet someone energetically with compassion, it actually allows them to soften as well.
Totally.
And that's powerful.
Totally. You mentioned something earlier about boundaries. And just like we don't understand anger and we don't understand compassion, I also feel we don't understand even this concept of boundaries and actually what it means. Because for me, at the moment, one of the greatest issues on the planet is this constant fear of other people's opinions and caring what Lael thinks about me and what she's saying about me. I try and fit into these imaginary expectations of others, right? Immediately losing my authenticity. And then I'm thinking, well, hang on a sec. I don't even know what you think about me. And maybe it's not my life task. And maybe it's like, you do you, boo, and I'll do me. But as soon as I go out of that boundary, suddenly I'm anxious and stressed and I'm constantly worrying about what everyone else thinks about me. And of course, fear and anxiety are going to live there. So how do we create boundaries for ourselves along the way, even just understand what the concept means?
Well, again, without sounding like a broken record, I'm going to go back to the beginning of what we're taught about boundaries and what we're modeled, right? So for many of us, boundaries either look like this. They were either overpowering yelling, like, what I say goes. And, you know, and we say, but why? Because I said so. And
I'm right, you're wrong, shut up.
That's it. So boundaries were overpowering and non-flexible.
Yeah.
Or boundaries were really, really permissive. Right, which means, oh, I don't know, maybe. And you knew as a kid, if you just kept working the right angles, you get what you want, right?
Yeah, totally.
So it's rare that I've come across people that grew up in environments that had really healthy boundaries. Now, healthy boundaries also mean, from the adult's perspective, is, you know, they're setting a limit with a child, but they're also available to hear how the child feels about it. So we can say no to something, but it's also okay for the child to be upset about that. And we hold space for the feelings that are there because it's usually something that's fueling what's going on.
Yeah.
And boundaries are also respected by listening to strong yeses and nos. Now, again, if we kind of scale it back again, most of us were brought up to be good boys and good girls, which means that we often abandoned our boundaries and our yeses and nos in order to keep someone else happy.
Yeah.
So that's the imprint, right? That's what most of us have an overlay.
The pleaser.
That's kind it. Of, yeah, totally. That's what most of us have had, right? Unless I often say you were a super fiery child and you were like, you know what, well, I'm not going to deal with that. And then you basically push
you're
back
an outlier,
out on it, right?
Yeah.
But most of us kind of had the people-pleasing kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
So then it's not surprising that we grow up to be adults and we have really crappy relationship to boundaries and setting limits because most of our you know, stories around, well, does this person like me or is it going to be okay? And I think, again, it comes back to this place of connection to ourself. I can say no and it's actually okay if you're upset. Because that upset is yours.
Yeah, that's on you,
Now, that is really hard when we're still hardwired to be like, do you like me? Do you approve of me? Like, am I okay?
It's that constant tension between the need for attachment and the need for authenticity.
That's exactly it, right? And I think we have to learn, much like we're learning about compassion, we have to learn how to set boundaries for ourselves. And it's one of the big things I see, particularly in the parenting work I do, that parents have a really hard time setting boundaries because either it's really punitive and power over or it's really permissive. And actually what the kids need is really anchored, embodied boundaries. Yeah. You know, where a parent's like, hey, I've got this. It's not too big for me. It's a no. And you're allowed to feel upset about it, but it's still a no, right?
Yeah.
And when we can hold that for our children, again, they learn, ah, this is what a healthy boundary is. So then they learn to be able to set that with their friends, with other people, with themselves. So I think, again, it's we are having to unlearn a lot from what we were modeled, and now we're actually having to learn how to do it for ourselves. And that takes practice. And I often say to a lot of the parents I work with, you have to practice saying no and being in the uncomfortableness of it, and then also then seeing the evidence that it's also okay.
Totally.
Right? We need to actually practice with the small no's in order to get better with the big ones.
It's not my responsibility or my life task to say yes.
Yes, that's
to
it.
Everyone, getting back to that pleaser mentality.
Yeah. When we get really good at holding our boundaries, that's where we find our true power. That's actually where we are able to be free in who we need to be. And, and I often find this too, the more you are clear with your boundaries, the less people challenge them. Yeah, totally. When you are really wobbly with them, you'll get challenged on them all the time. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing to learn how to do it for ourselves. It's not easy. It's not easy. And I used to be the like queen of people pleasing. Like I had no boundaries. I was super crap at it. I was really all about making everyone happy all the time. But then it took that crisis. And for me, having PTSD and that whole stuff to actually learn how to say no, how to have strong yeses and nos, and actually how to take care of my needs. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Isn't that crazy? Mm. Your greatest growth comes from your darkest times, yeah?
That's it.
Unlocking your authenticity.
That's it.
Starting with imperfection.
Yeah, that's it.
And a dance rave as well.
Yeah.
I just find it fascinating where people have these ahas. Mm. And sometimes it's a slow burn and sometimes it's a big, massive in your face.
Yeah.
Kind of, and I think, I feel like in the absence of those, it's how we can educate the world. Speaking of which, now we're heading out to your school.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm fascinated about at the moment, so we've covered elements of anger, covered elements of compassion, covered elements of boundaries. I'm fascinated with intrinsic motivations because for me, it's, I feel like one of the reasons the world's so distracted is in the absence of tapping into our intrinsic motivations, which is really going just internal to make sense of who we are.
Yeah.
We're all going external and getting distracted by extrinsic motivations, you know, money, fame, identity, recognition, status, all these kind of things, which on some level aren't bad.
Yeah.
It's when they become to the detriment of our intrinsic motivations.
Yeah.
And for me, the three categories of intrinsic motivations, it's also the same three reasons we go to work or get in flow as an athlete, is play, purpose, and potential.
Yes.
Yeah, purpose meaning just finding stuff that really means something to me, really matters to me. And potential is just the growth and the learning to get out of our comfort zone.
Mm.
But the one I'm fascinated in at the moment is play. Because the opposite isn't work, it's fear, right?
Mm.
I feel like, what's your relationship with play? Because I've seen you talk about in terms of attachment play and other almost like segmentation play. Can you talk me through that? Because I just feel like we've also lost that art form being more playful as a human race.
Well, I think the thing is first with playfulness is that we've got to feel safe to play.
Yeah.
Which is, it's like, you know, sometimes when you run workshops or you go to workshops and people are like, right, we're going to do like a warm-up exercise and everyone goes, oh, God.
Icebreaker.
Hate this, right? Yeah. Because it puts them out of their comfort zone, right? But I think we have to, as adults, get better at feeling safe enough to play, right? And so that's where it's doing it with someone who feels safe for you. And that's where it can be fun with girlfriends or mates, and you go and do something out of your comfort zone, right? That allows you to laugh and play. And nobody ever says they go and do something like that and think, gosh, I wish I hadn't have done that. Mm. Everyone goes, that was so fun.
Totally.
We should do that again, right? But we don't make it a priority.
Yeah.
So I think it's about having the courage to kind of step out of our comfort zone. I think it's about finding the safety, so having people with you that make you feel safe enough that you can do that with.
And safe could be also, I mean, we talk about embrace your weird, right?
Mm.
So it's kind of like, don't care what others think about
that's
you.
Yeah.
But if you can just have the courage to be you.
Yeah.
In all that weirdness and all that playfulness.
Yes.
That's an element of safety too, yeah.
Yes, that's it. Totally, that's totally it. And I think it is, again, you know, I often look at play, which often can lead to laughter. Laughter is such a powerful stress release. Like, it is a release like crying and feeling those big feelings. And when we've talked about repression, you know, we hold so tight. The antidote to repression is connection.
Mm.
So when we can bring that beautiful connection and laughter in, then we're actually loosening up the stuck feelings that allow us to actually feel more. And then that also then allows us to have more compassion. I mean, it all works together.
Totally.
Really.
Because I think it feels like play unlocks imagination and spontaneity and opportunity and surprise and wonder and awe and all these incredible things that we crave.
Yeah.
It's just we don't know how to start the process or start small. And you're right about safe, whether it's safe in the environment or safe in ourselves. Life suddenly became more serious.
It did and it's even more serious now because we're given that message of success and achieve. And actually, again, if we bring it back to, well, what is success? A calm nervous system, you know, feeling connected to your family and your friends. And that is often where that play space sits, right? And so if we can kind of keep taking steps towards facilitating more of that, we're going to get back to that place of deep, you know, calm and peace and success within.
What is success? A calm nervous system. It's like, who knew? So can we, I know this is a big word and a big topic and I don't truly understand it, but you put me onto Dr. Marte, mm-hmm. Gabor Marte, and yeah. It was the first time I understood that I had a light bulb moment about how we judge people by their behaviours. Mm-hmm. We don't double click and find the story behind the story. Mm-hmm. So can you just first and foremost just kind of explain behaviorism? Because mm-hmm. It goes to the core of not just our education system, but mm-hmm. so many systems.
Yeah.
And it's so flawed on so many levels.
Yeah. You have to just do a Yui here yep. and then go back to the freeway. Cool. Not that I need to give you directions.
No, no, no.
Don't you hate it when someone
gives
you directions?
It's all right. I'm often asking someone a really deep question and they go, hey, Ben, you can go the light's green. Okay. Yeah, no worries.
Okay.
We'll get back to the deep and heavy conversation.
All right, let's go back to behaviorism. Okay. Well, I think to understand what it is, it's really the concept that that when you are good, I will give you attention and love, and when you are bad, I will take that away from you.
It's conditional again.
Yeah, it's totally conditional. So most of us as adults now grew up in a behaviorism paradigm, which was really about... And that really plays into the whole punishments and rewards thing
totally.
That is still very, very big today. So, you know, I think as humans, if we kind of strip back again to the core of who we are, I really don't believe that anyone does better by being made to feel worse. So you think about the impact of shame.
Can you say that again?
I don't think anyone does better by being made to feel worse.
Yeah. I love that.
Right. Now, yes, some people go, yeah, but that's driven me to prove myself. But has it driven you to do something because you've got an intrinsic motivation to do it and to feel good about it, or do it to try and prove that you're worthy of someone's love, right? So I think that when we come back to understanding that most of our world has been set up on this behaviorism paradigm, our school system set up on that, when you behave, when you do what I want, I'll give you a gold star, I will praise you, and when you don't, then I'll put your name up on the board or I'll take something away from you.
Yeah.
Now, for those kids, when we take something away from them or put their name up in the board, well, where does their energy go? It goes to shame. It goes to I'm not good enough. It goes to there's something wrong with me. And so in some children, that will fire a desire to I'm going to show you or I'll prove that I'm not that. And it may create this sense of drive in them to succeed, which I'm sure you've seen with probably a lot of top athletes of what's driven their story to do it.
Yeah, they believe, I think it's called perfect, perform, repeat.
Yeah.
Like if I play the perfect game of football, my dad will love me.
Yes.
And it's conditional upon that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Or what happens is then we just kind of have that story that says I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, I'm not lovable, and you know we sit in that shame and like what we've talked about today, that lack of compassion for ourselves and that really harsh inner critic that goes on. So I think
it's emotional pressure driving.
Totally. Is,
yeah, not the intrinsic love of play. Yep.
So I think, and again, this is I get pretty fired up and passionate about this because
that's good. It's necessary.
Punishments. Again, all they do is serve to make someone feel bad about themselves, right? Now, when we look at it from a parenting point of view, that when our child does something wrong, which all kids are going to, there's a strong belief system that's been in our narrative for a long time that says, I need to make you feel bad in order for you to do better. And so I'm going to take your phone away from you, or you're not allowed to, you know, have ice cream tonight, or whatever is the punishment. But what punishments do, and I found this over many years of working with families, is it teaches kids to get really good at lying, right? Because why on earth would you tell the truth if you're going to get in trouble
totally.
Or taken away from you? And when we think about what is so vital in families, it is connection. And it is, I say to parents all the time, you want to have teenagers that know they can come to you when things are hard. You want to know that you are the parents they're going to call when someone's passed out at a party because they're drunk. Or you want to be the parents where the kids go, don't worry, my parents will not judge us and they'll help, right? But for a lot of kids, when something goes wrong, and particularly in those teenage years, the default is, God, I hope my parents don't find out. Right, because I'm going to be in trouble, and that's not what we want.
They're not going to love me. Yeah.
Yeah, we want our kids to feel safe. We want them to know they're going to mess up and make mistakes. So, you know, we're there to help guide them. And again, it doesn't mean that we don't have boundaries.
Yeah.
And I think again, you're bringing up that point about perfectionism and we're all beautifully imperfect. We have to model to our children healthy ways to be in the world. So, you know, we loop back to what we're talking about with anger. What do we model to our children about anger? Like what they've learned perhaps about anger is that you slam the door and you yell And then we get angry at them for doing that, right? Whereas we are far better off when we are angry. And I say this to adults all the time. Our children are hardwired to be connected to us. So they know when something's off with us, right? So when we are angry and a child comes up to you and says, "Dad, are you angry?" And we go, "No, I'm fine," like this. Then what happens is the child goes, "Well, my gut tells me that you're upset and you're angry, but you're telling me you're not, so maybe my gut's wrong." And it actually teaches them to distrust their intuition. We are far better off going.
I wish I knew that 20 years ago,
Layla. Yeah, I know.
I think you're doing the right thing by everything's okay, being the alpha male.
Yeah.
And yet at its core, you're just teaching them that maybe they're off.
Yeah, yeah.
Because their intuition is so on. Yeah.
And so we're better off going, "I'm angry and you know what, I'm going to go for a run because that helps me. Or I'm going to put on some music and do some angry dancing and, you know, whatever." And it's the same with feeling sad. You know, when we're feeling sad and our child comes up and says, "You okay?" We're much better off saying, "I actually feel really sad today, but I'm going to go call a friend because I feel better when I speak to someone, or I'm going to have a cry, or I'm going to do some journaling." Like, we have to show them the healthy ways to move the feelings. And it's the same with making mistakes. We have to model making mistakes.
Yeah.
We, you know, I talk about that we used to have in our family, what was the biggest fail of your day at dinner time. So we talk about what we're grateful for and we go, "What was your biggest fail today?" And so it was to be able to share the places we'd made mistakes. And, you know, we'd say stuff that the kids would laugh at. But what was happening in that dynamic is we were all seeing, hey, we all make mistakes. We all can learn how to repair, and we're still enough even if we mess up.
Totally. And so the relatability of our mistakes is what connects us. Yeah.
Totally, totally. So when we kind of come back to the punishments and rewards piece and the behaviorism stuff, you know, when we're punishing again with our kids, we're often teaching them that, you know, I don't accept these parts of you, right? And you must do better. And my essence of what I really believe is this: children do better when they feel better. Like, a child's natural state is to want to please us, is to want to connect.
Yeah.
But sometimes there's just stuff that gets in the way. And that can be their needs aren't being met. It can be that there's a whole lot of stress and trauma sitting there in the way. It can be because they feel unsafe. So they're always trying to find their way back into balance to connect with us. But sometimes stuff gets in the way, and we're the ones that sometimes miss it. You know, we miss the cues.
Totally, totally.
And I think, again, too, you know, but people often say to me, though, "But how do kids learn?" And I'm like, well, kids learn, again, about doing something wrong when they feel connected to know that, hey, I can mess up, and yes, maybe I need to repair or I need to do something to fix whatever's gone on. But when they know there's a safe parent there to help them navigate it, that's where they learn the lesson. So I often tell the story about my son when he was about, I think, 14 or so.
Yeah.
And it was that classic, he said, "I'm going to my mate's place." And his mate said he was coming to our house, and they were at neither house, right?
Yeah.
And so
that's never happened before, has it?
No, never.
You and I never did that, did we?
Totally.
Yeah.
So we cottoned on to it, right? And so then we texted him. We gave him the opportunity to kind of fess up, and he didn't, right? And so then we called him, and we're like, "Mate, we know we're not where you are. Like, we're gonna come get you. Come home, right?" So he comes home. And quite rightly, like, my husband and I were both like, oh, you know, he lied and we had feelings about it. But, you know, I said to Mike, "Let's deal with our feelings first before we go speak to him. Let's move whatever's here," right? So we had in our own reactions, "I feel angry, I feel disappointed." So we took that out somewhere else, so we didn't project that onto him. And then we came back to him and we sat down and I said to him, "I am really sorry if I've let you down in not making it safe enough for you to tell me the truth." And he looked at me like, well, like, that's not what I was expecting, right? And I said, "You know, I want you to feel safe enough to tell me the truth. So I want to know what's going on here." And then he stopped and he said, because they went to a girl's house, and he said, "Mom, you just get so excited when I hang out with girls, and I couldn't deal with you getting all excited about it, so I just didn't want to tell you." And I was like, got it. And I was like, "I am so sorry." In my deep need to make it comfortable enough around for him,
yeah,
I was too over the top. And he's like, "I actually just want some privacy." And I said, "I hear you. Right, so I'm going to pull back on that, but I really want you to know that one of our biggest values is just knowing where you are so we know that you're safe." And he goes, "Got it." And that was the last time he ever lied to us, right?
Oh, wow.
Because I could have come in hot on that, right? And be like, you lied to us, you can't go out next week and da-da-da. But what's that going to do? That's actually just going to make him feel angry with us. It's going to create more disconnection. Mm-hmm. Or we can actually come in with, okay, there's something for us all to learn here, us included. How do we do that?
But if you just looked at it, so the behavior, getting back to behaviorism, if you just looked at the behavior,
yeah,
and you would apply that carrot or stick kind of approach to
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I make you wrong. You've done something wrong. You're bad.
So is the antidote to behaviorism, is it compassion and curiosity kind of combined? Is it, how would you say?
Yeah, well, I think it's
an alternative way to...
The alternative way is, we come back to that curiosity again, there's always a reason for the behaviour.
Yeah.
We always have to look behind the behaviour.
Yeah.
And this doesn't just apply to kids, this applies to everyone.
It's the story behind the story.
Yeah, this is our partners, our work colleagues. When they're bringing something hot to us, right, and they're angry or there's something, our first thought really has got to be, I wonder what's going on here for them. Because when we can come in with curiosity and we come in with connection, then that actually creates safety, so that whatever is driving what's going on is more likely to be presented. But when we come in with defense and we come in with kind of power over and shame, we've got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
Right? We've just only got disconnection.
Yeah.
So the opposite really to behaviorism is firstly for us to be anchored and calm enough in ourselves to be curious, right? So it's very hard to be that if we're feeling stressed and triggered, and I know it's not easy, and full compassion to all the parents out there who've got little ones at home and you're like, yeah, this all sounds good in theory, but how do you do it?
Yeah.
It's hard in the younger years, there is no doubt, right? Because we're parenting without the support and the resources that we often need.
Yeah, and we just got to be a little percent off ourselves, and we're off
totally.
Our game.
And then we're off it, right?
Yeah.
But I often think the work of parenting is to do our own work. Is if you want to be a good parent, then you've got to know your own story and you've got to do your own healing work so that you can turn up and be kind of the most spacious, anchored version of yourself.
Yeah.
Like, that's the goal.
Yeah.
Well, that's been often my goal. So every time something's pushed up with my kids, you know, I've learned over the years to go, what is this about for me? What am I making it mean?
Yeah.
What's being triggered for me? Where's this at? And if I can kind of do my work and look at it, then I'm more likely to come back to them with some calm and space and be able to work through what's going on.
Totally. So if someone wants to, let's say a teenager or a parent or anyone wants to do the work, right?
Mm.
Hit rock bottom and go, well, nothing else is working.
Yeah.
I want to do the work on myself first. Yeah. Where do they start? Is it with their imprints, and it's making sense of their own story first? And what would be your advice to someone who wants to go on that journey?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is to be curious about what pisses you off. Like, what triggers you, right? Because that's you don't have to look hard, I think.
You need a longer road trip.
I think the thing is to start with, where do you lose your energy, right? Where do you go, God, I wish I hadn't have said yes to that? Or, gosh, I get really angry about that, or I really hate that. Like, we just have to look at where the parts that we're not feeling centered or connected. And then, I mean, I usually just ask a few questions. So the first question is, you know, what am I feeling? And then my second question is, do I know this feeling from somewhere, right? So that could be, yeah, I know this feeling. It's this feeling of frustration. And I used to get this with my brother all the time because he would never listen to me. And you go, beautiful. So there's a piece there that's kind of guiding you to, maybe there's some feelings that are still there that haven't been dealt with.
The role modeling from learned experience
So we can be like, what am I making this mean? What does this remind me of? You know, do I know this feeling from somewhere?
Yeah.
And sometimes these can be beautiful journal prompts that you do. And as you write that, I often find that we will often get taken back to the parts of our story when we didn't get our needs met. Like, that inner child part of us will often surface. And it's there from that space that we sometimes need to do that healing work. And sometimes that can look like just being compassionate to 7-year-old you, you know, who didn't get picked in the basketball team and felt lots of sadness or shame about it. And now when you didn't get picked for that promotion, you're right back in that feeling again. And what you actually need to do is just give some love to that 7-year-old you and give it the words that it needed at the time that it didn't get. You know, I find that most of the healing work I've done with adults is sometimes going back to those inner stories and imprints and actually giving that younger part of us the stuff that it needed that it didn't get at the time.
Totally.
Yeah.
I feel like there's so many different forms of just leaning into compassion.
Yeah. Well, I think it's being a curious observer of life, isn't it? And it's that question, what am I making this mean? Like, really, what is the story I'm attaching to what's going on here? And I think that is... That's one of the most powerful questions we can ask ourselves, because when you do that, you're actually taking responsibility for your feelings.
Yeah.
You're not making it about what the other person is doing. And that's actually where we find our power.
Yeah.
When we can own, wow, I've created a whole story about this, or this is tapping me into some younger feelings here that feel painful. When we're able to own that and sit in that story, that is where we then get to transform it. Because we're not waiting on someone else to change or to get the promotion or for our kids to behave better in order to feel good, right? We are totally. Actually taking responsibility for our life, and that's the work, right? That's the key.
Yeah, yeah. God, that's a big topic.
It is big, isn't it? And I know we're talking about it a bit frivolously here, but it's, I mean, it's deep work, right? And it takes time, and again, you've got to be kind to yourself as you do it. And I just love to remind people all the time that most of us were not taught this in our family of origin, right? So we're like the first generation doing this work. We're the ones that are breaking the back of it. And like I've talked about, like I see it in my kids, you probably see it in your kids too, because we've kind of maybe done some of this work or changed some of the story, it is so much more natural for them.
Totally.
And imagine what their kids will be like.
Yeah.
So it's hard. It's hard work. It's not easy, right?
But it's, yeah, totally. It's just necessary.
It's worth it.
Yeah.
It's worth it. It's a long game. It's totally worth it.
Thank you, my friend. It's been an absolute joy taking you for a ride.
My pleasure. That was good. Well, I think we ticked off most of life's big questions.
Yeah. If we ever to write a book together, that'd be, we've got some big issues there.
We do.
Lael Stone, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.